I will call this May 22nd, 2012, meeting of the Joint Legislative Task Force on County Payments to order. I have a few structure lessons here, how we want to do this. First, I want to explain for those that may be listening that may not really totally understand exactly why we're meeting about this particular agenda today, and that is that we have been faced with the very serious reductions to our county revenues, as those many of you in the room know. And so in order to address the loss of this revenue, in the February 2012 session, there were three bills that were passed. This is going to be the discussion on the agenda that is just beginning to show up. The first bill was House Bill 4175, and it set aside the statute that limited the county road funds. In other words, this is going to allow counties, if they should so choose, to use their road funds, but it also limits that to being able to use those road funds for patrol, law enforcement efforts. It is not to use for their general fund or to help them get over the next year's expenses. The bill strictly limits it to law enforcement. House Bill 4176 addresses a process that the counties can go through, a review process, that if it is declared a fiscal emergency, then it sets a process for them and it establishes what we call a fiscal assistance board. In the bill, it says that the county, if they are selected as a county that has an emergency, that this county would endure some of the cost of that board, that fiscal emergency board. And then there was House Bill 4177, which addresses the CAF funds, and that is the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance. Those funds, that sometimes if people listening on the phone and they've come to me and talked to me about that, that is a complex issue, and I'm just hoping that all of you that are here understand a little bit about what those funds are and how we happen to get them. But it would allow them to continue to get those funds even under certain conditions in those bills. Now, those bills set an interesting record, because it is very difficult for those of us who have a local government background to understand getting three local government bills quickly through this process. I believe Mr. MacArthur might agree with this, was unprecedented. And so there was a real effort on the part of the legislature to try to do something to address this crisis that we have with our counties. We have with us today some county commissioners that are going to be testifying. We have two that are going to be here in the room with us, and then we have four that are on the phone. And so what I would like to suggest, the order that I would like for you to go through is we're going to have the two commissioners that are in the room to come forward to the table, introduce themselves, and give their testimony. After their testimony, I would like the four commissioners on the phone then to give their testimony addressing the implementation of the bills that I just went through. I would ask that when we follow that with the Q&A, that the people on the task force address the commissioners in a way that is clear to the people on the phone who you are speaking to. You might do that by using both of their names, first and last. You might also address them first and last and address the county which they represent. And I think that way, people listening to the process and procedure can follow it. It makes it very difficult if someone knows someone and says, well, Bill, you know, you said this. Who is Bill? I don't know who Bill is. And so the other additional thing is that we want to thank the AOC for bringing the pictures. These are the people, task force members, that you are looking at. These are the people on the phone. And so that makes it very easy for you to see and understand exactly who you're talking to. So, Beth, do we have the phone open, the lines open now?
Yes,
okay,
Trevor.
Well, I want to, first I want to welcome Commissioner Sid Lyken from Lane County to the table, and Al Switzer, Commissioner from Klamath County. Switzer, excuse me. And then on the phone, I welcome Commissioner Rhodes, Commissioner Waddle, Commissioner Itzen?
Itzen, I believe.
Okay. And Commissioner Hare. And also the sheriff from Curry County, John Bishop, and Jim Colin, the assessor from Curry County. So you have quite a delegation there, Curry County. Thank you. That's very, very good. And now I'm going to open an informational meeting and welcome the two gentlemen at the dais. You'll introduce yourselves, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Are you going first?
Yeah.
I'm Commissioner Al Switzer from Klamath County. And to tell you how the bills worked for us, I need to go back about a year and tell you what our financial shape was a year ago. Our jail consists of three pods, A, B, and C. A pod is the booking, holding, female and high security pod. It has 58 prisoners. We'll house 58 prisoners. The B pod is a general population pod of 44 prisoners. And the C pod is a general population pod of 44 prisoners. We have not used the C pod for a number of years due to just finances. So we were looking at closing the B pod. And in fact, we closed it for a time, and it turned out to be pretty much a disaster. So we were on the catch and release and book and release policy. So we went to the city of Klamath Falls, and we traded with them, after we got the Attorney General's okay, $700,000 of road funds and restricted road funds to them, and they gave us $700,000 of unrestricted general funds. And then we took $300,000 from our patrol budget, moved it over to the jail side, and we funded the pod, which is the $1 million. Now we come up into the budget that where the bills start to make a difference. We were $2.5 million in the hole because primarily of secured rural schools, a lowering of the property taxes, which everybody's going through, and the lesser cut on the state forest, which we participate in Klamath. So we had to make up $2.5 million. At that point, B pod was going to be closed completely. And at that point, we would be arresting people, booking them, and releasing them. And it was just how it was going to work. We brought our department heads together, and they came up with $1.2 million of cuts. That was round one. Round two, the Board of Commissioners and the Budget Committee made the final $1.3 million of cuts. In that final cut was $100,000 to the DA, $100,000 to juvenile, and $158,000 to the sheriff. Now, that was the first cuts that we had to make into the sheriff's budget other than closing the VPOD. Thanks to you, and believe me, we thank you deeply, House Bill 4175 bailed Klamath County out. We took and committed $4 million of road funds for 2 years, so $2 million, $2 million, $4 million total. And this is what we did with the $2 million this year. We opened up the B-Pod. That was a million of the two. We gave $100,000 back to the DA, $100,000 back to juvenile, and $150,000 back to the sheriff. Those are the round two cuts. So we made the sheriff as whole as he was going to be. We've already taken massive cuts in the sheriff's department. We made him as whole as we could make him. And then we added back Meals on Wheels, the trapper, and soil conservation. And we ended up with $400,000. We put the $400,000 in a reserve. We have five union contracts we're negotiating this year. Plus, we're negotiating health care. So that's where that's setting, and you've all gone through that drill. You kind of know where that is. Without House Bill 4175, Klamath County would not have the jail, and we would not have patrol, because it's kind of critical. We took the $300,000 that we had moved over from patrol into the jail. We were able to put that back into patrol, and then the $158,000. So we've got $458,000 to try to fund some patrol. That's only about five people, but still, it's a lot more than we had. Right now, today, to give you an idea, Klamath County is 6,000 square miles. It takes us about 2.5 hours to drive from one end of the county to the other. You're a little over the speed limit, but you can make it 2.5 hours. Representative McClain probably knows that. We've got to cover a huge amount of territory, and this is what we have on staff to cover that right now. We have seven patrol officers, and we have four detectives. That gives us 11 people to cover 24/7, 6,000 square miles. We also have three SROs, student resource officers, but they are dedicated into the schools and paid for partially by us, partially by the schools. We have one forest BLM officer that's paid for by the forest and the BLM, and we have two marine officers that are paid for by Marine. Those additional people we can use in an emergency, but they're basically contracted out. That's what keeps us going. We are not at 24/7. We have a night shift that runs from 5 p.m. to 3 a.m. Usually that has three officers for the 6,000 square miles. Sometimes we get a fourth, but generally three. We also have a day shift that is covered by our detectives, and we use a lot of call-outs, a lot of overtime. I had one of the sheriff's officers' wives talk to me and tell me that her husband hadn't been home in almost 5 days, because we just call out. Can't keep doing that. We're going to just wear these people out, or they're going to make a mistake, or we're going to have something that's going to be terrible. So right now we're trying to hire the four additional people, and hopefully we've got this covered for another year. So we'll have 2 year cycles is what we are looking for. As far as House Bill 4176, we did not use it. We felt that we were okay within our means, so we stayed with what we had. And 4177 CAFA, we do participate in the CAFA, but we are a donor county, so we have been donating into that program for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, I just didn't have it back, but I don't think that's going to work that way. But so we didn't participate in that either. We're solid where that is, and we're pretty solid with our assessment taxation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll have Commissioner Lykin give his testimony, and then we'll open for Q&A.
Senator Verger and members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Sid Lykin, and currently I'm the chair of the Lane County Board of Commissioners. And I'm only my second year on the board after previously serving as 10 years as the mayor of the city of Springfield. My testimony will be a little bit shorter. I appreciate, though, Commissioner Schweitzer giving, I think, quite a bit of detail on what's going on with Klamath County. As far as Lane County is concerned, As many of you know, we have been historically with the second largest recipient of Securable Schools money behind Douglas County, even though it was pretty neck and neck, pretty close between the two. Lane County is roughly the size of Connecticut, size-wise, but really, if you look at the county as a whole, about 70% plus, it's urban. And with Eugene, Springfield being the two largest cities, but then you include Cottage Grove, Florence, Junction City, Crestwell, Cottage Grove, Oak Ridge, and so on and so forth. It's a fairly urban county. And so when you look at what, really when you look at some of the services that we're looking to cut, basically what we did this year, the county administrator went through, met with all the department heads, met with the sheriff, met with the district attorney, and in order to kind of see the forecast, and originally we were forecasting about a $13.5 million deficit, that's about a $16 million deficit now, because obviously, as you well know, the forecasts haven't been coming in as strong as we were hoping. What it amounts to is about a 25% cut across the board in every department, including the sheriff's department, including the district attorney. And the only one department where you're maybe not going to get that kind of cut will be taxation assessment. And a lot of that is depending on the back and forth going on with our assessor and the Department of Revenue, is with that 15%, hopefully that keeps us in meeting the formula for the CAFA grant, which will be very key. And like Klamath County, Lane County is very much a donor county as well. And so that's that kind of gives you an idea. Congratulations, Al. You have one more patrol officer than what we will have. And so we're literally looking at six, and not 24, seven. We're looking at six, maybe covering 20 hours. And that's basically what we're looking at this point in time. I think we were, from Lane County's perspective, we were very supportive of House Bill 4175. As you know, that Lane County and Douglas County have been able to participate in this over the last few years, is making sure we can use the road fund money to fund our patrol. And so that's been a benefit. So I'm glad to see the other timber counties as well. So I want to thank you very much for that. It's been a real benefit for Lane County over the years, and so I want to say thank you from our perspective. Thank you for that, especially as an ongoing mechanism that we can continue to be involved in. Right now, we're looking at FY 2013 to transfer about $850,000, but that could go as high as $2.8 million. And we're going through our budget process now. In fact, hopefully our last budget committee is tonight. So we'll have, actually, the committee will hopefully adopt the recommendation. So the numbers may change what we have right now based on after tonight, and especially on that one. As far as House Bill 4176, again, I think it's a good mechanism to have in place. We did not participate in it as well. I guess our point was we felt like we need to spend the money to have somebody come in and tell us that we're broke. I think that's pretty much we have an idea that we're where we are. And I think even prior when I ran, I actually sat down with a group of business folks who have strong, significant financial backgrounds and actually had them look at our budget and the potential. I was saying, you know, at this point in time, the next 2 years, so this was 2 years ago, I said, we may be looking at $30 million to cut. Well, it was only 25, so, you know, that was a saving grace, I guess. But so this is what we're looking at. I had people kind of look over there, where we are financially, what we're going to look like. And I think folks knew then that it was going to be a real challenge in Lane County to continue to provide some of those key services from our general fund. And as far as House Bill 4177, it's one that I strongly believe in. And I want to, again, I say thank you very much. I've had some folks actually say, gee, do you need an assessor? And I said, well, if you want to have somebody to collect the money to make sure that you do have Sheriff's Patrol, yes. And so that's something I think is is important for our counties. But overall, as we move forward, I think we'll have a better idea tonight after our budget committee and get an idea. Right now, the medical examiner, the district attorney, has cut out the medical examiner completely. That's a high priority. That's the number one priority in our budget committee. So I believe we have some maybe creative opportunities to make sure that's going to be funded. I was able to come up here about, I guess, a week or two ago and talk with Sarah Gates from the governor's office, as well as their general counsel, and Dr. Gunson, as well as state police, talk about the medical examiner and how we might be able to partner. I think ultimately that's really what, you know, you hate to use those overused words in politics, But I think if we're going to get continue to get through this, those terms partnership and collaboration are going to have to be used more and more, only actually mean it. And so I look forward to that, and I look forward to the dialogue that we're going to have today as well. So, again, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. Much appreciated.
All right, questions. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. For both of you who accessed your road fund money, what was your balance in the road fund before you got into it?
$105 million.
$105 million. And for you, Commissioner Lycan?
57. I think it's about 57.
Thank you.
57 million.
Very much. Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow-up.
What has been the general reaction of your communities with respect to accessing those funds?
I would have
said it better.
That was one of the bad words. I think it's a...
Excuse me. Those of you on the phone, perhaps you should mute your phone until you're ready to speak. All right. Thank you. Now, Commissioner, go forward.
I think it's a mixed bag, Senator. I've had some people thought it was a great move. I've had other people just said, how could you possibly go into those road funds? I also had the opportunity to have the school lobby come down on us pretty hard about using the road funds for police. So they felt the road fund should be used for schools, not police. So it was a mixed bag. I don't know. We didn't do any polling, but I got calls on both sides of the issue. To me, it made a lot of sense. Our county has ONC land, but it also has a vast majority of our land is federal forest land. And so our reserves tend to be in the road funds. They don't tend to be in the general fund. And so for us to be able to survive, we need to be able to move those funds where we need to use them. And, you know, quite frankly, we did a survey on our roads 3 years ago. Our paving index is like 83%. It's one of the highest in the state. Roads are in good shape. This is not going to be where we're all of a sudden just not going to have good roads. Could we continue to do that for a long period of time? No, I don't think you could. But I think for a short period of time, I think it works fine.
Thank you.
I think from our perspective, because we've been able to access this for a few years, that I think it's become somewhat commonplace. And but I will say this, and I think it's important, though, as SRS funds have, in a sense, at least the program has stopped. And depending on what happens with this federal transportation bill, if this even moves forward, the one thing I would caution, though, is that with the road funds, you're looking at potential infrastructure. So if you, I think the piece here is to, if there's going to be economic development opportunities, you got to be prepared. And you can't bleed the road funds dry just for public safety only when those economic development opportunities that could present themselves, expand the property tax base, so more revenue eventually comes in. So that's one of the things for me, is to kind of caution. But again, I think from the urban standpoint, it's really not seen as all that significant. I think rural Lane County does appreciate the fact that this is an opportunity to fund rural patrol.
Thank you.
The questions. Co-Chair Hannah.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioners, thank you. Those of you at the dais and on the phone as well, appreciate you being here, and I appreciate Commissioner Schweitzer, your level of detail. Commissioner Lycan, you made a comment, and I'm not giving a direct quote, but something along the line, talking about 4176, we don't need somebody to come tell us we're broke. And I've heard that a couple of times today, talking about this specific issue. But I want to go back to the creation of that particular piece of legislation, which, if you go back and look at it, what it requires is the county to come to the state and say, we're broke. The Fiscal Assistance Board is not about anybody from this body coming to say to county bodies, hey, we're going to look at your numbers and tell you whether you're broke or not. In order to form the Fiscal Assistance Board, you have to have already acknowledged that. So it was our way of saying, here's how we deal with shared services And so I'm anxious, and it may not be today from any of you, but because that perception is out there, I'm anxious to hear why that perception is out there that for some reason this was this committee or task force's way of saying, we want to come tell you you're broke. It was not, and I think I can look around the room and say, nobody here had that intention. The intention was when you, as elected officials locally, say, we're broke, you come and we say, let's put some people together and talk about shared services. So I hope that's a gap we can close, and I know you're working hard, and all of you and your counties are doing that. I mean, we live in those same counties, so we know. But our goal at the time was to find a way to collaborate the services that we jointly provide, primarily public safety and public health, along with the election side. So I want the public to hear us say that the intention truly was to talk about shared services, not to have anybody tell you either you've erred or you've made a mistake or you haven't done a good job managing your finances. It's just the reality of the situation we're in, and we're going to share services.
Senator Virger, if I could just maybe give just a snapshot answer to that. I think Senator Virger, Co-Chair Hannah, I think part of it, though, really, and from my perspective, and I can only speak as one commissioner, so I'm only speaking to you as one commissioner, but as a whole, the Lane County Board, and really from my background for 12 years serving in the city, it's probably the home rule piece that probably reaches into our background as much as anything. And so, and to hear you say that, though, I will say that's probably the channel that I think that we could be beneficial in opening those channels up. And I think that goes back to the partnership collaboration piece. So I think from our perspective or some of the folks' perspective, it really is the home rule piece as much as anything, and saying, okay, what are we looking, what are we giving up this time, and or potentially, you know, what are you giving up? And so to hear you say that, though, I must say I think that clearly opens maybe our eyes even more to really work with you on this. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
And I want to point out one other piece, if I may, and I'll be very brief. The other piece is intentionally in the drafting of that rule, the elected officials from the county who are the participant county members of the Fiscal Assistance Board and the appointed members from the governor must by majority of both groups. That's what protected local decision making. I mean, that was the other piece to at the recommendation of commissioners. It's like, wait a minute, we don't want you, i.e. we don't want the state coming here and telling us what to do. Got it. So it takes a majority of both the elected officials from the county and the appointed members to get a decision out of the board. And again, I just want to say it publicly because truly it was an idea that was meant to be, let's talk about how we handle shared services. Let's make sure you still have, you local counties have decision-making authority. If you say, you know what, I don't like the decision of the people that got appointed by the governor, don't worry. But it keeps that local authority in hand, provides an opportunity to have that conversation of how do we do the services. So I want to have more conversation about it, and I very much appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannah. Any other questions? Questions or comments? All right. Then we're going to go to the people on the phone. And I think that in order for us to just have a little bit of procedure here, that I will call on the commissioner by name, and then if you'll give us your testimony about the implementation of any one of these three bills. So let's start with Commissioner Rhodes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity. I also want to echo my fellow commissioners that have already testified before you the appreciation that we have for the efforts put forth by this committee. We actually have utilized Senate Bill 4175. We allocated in our next year's budget $700,000 to fund our deputies, and we've also looked at other opportunities that have enabled us to create a budget that will get us through this next fiscal year. In regards to House Bill 4176, the real issue was not, from my perspective anyway, it was not from where the help was going to come from. It was being able to pay for it. If you know you're broke, there's no money to pay, and we were told that it would be a minimum of $75,000 and possibly could exceed that, and we had no funding in place to pay for that service. So that was the real issue for us. We certainly would not have said no to any help or any outside opportunities to discuss with the governor's office and representatives of the state to talk about shared services. In fact, we did so with the DAS, with Sarah Gates and Michael Jordan. They were kind enough to come down to Curry County. We had some discussions regarding those issues, and certainly appreciated all the efforts by all the parties involved. And we'll continue to look forward to that kind of cooperation in the future as we move forward. We will utilize, I'm going to let our assessor, Jim Cullen, talk to the issues of 4177, but there again, I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I want to restate the fact that 4175 and 4176 can be some tools that we can use, given the fact that maybe 4176 can be adjusted to create some way to eliminate the cost to the counties. There again, if a county's broke, it doesn't make sense to send in a bill.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Rhodes. Because, members, that we have six people that will be speaking on the phone, I'm going to open the Q&A to Commissioner Rhodes right now, so that if anybody has a question for him, co-chair. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Commissioner Rhodes. The balance of your road fund prior to the $750,000 taken out of it, what was that?
It was $33 million.
Thank you.
Other questions for Commissioner Rhodes? All right. Commissioner Waddle?
Thank you, Senator, for allowing us to testify for you by you and your fellow task force members. I'm going to defer to our Chair David Itzen in the essence of time here. I'll be more than willing to answer any questions. Also, I believe our assessor as well as our sheriff may have an opportunity to provide some more insight.
All right. Thank you very much. Commissioner Itzen?
Thank you, Co-Chair Berger, Hannah Roblin, and committee members. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on these three bills. If I may, I'd like to begin with House Bill 4175, and again express appreciation on behalf of the Curry County Commission for the changes that you made. It has enabled us to extend the life of our county considerably due to those changes. I would like to defer to our sheriff, John Bishop, who is here, who may have some comments about this specific bill. And then, with your permission, move to House Bill 4177. We have our county tax collector, Assessor Jim Cullen, here as well. So with your permission, I'd like to ask Sheriff Bishop to comment.
Sheriff Bishop?
Yes, thank you, Senator. The only thing I would have, I'll try to be as brief as I can. 4175 will allow us to go at least one more fiscal year. We were looking at shutting the whole patrol down. Unfortunately, our jail is not a pod system. It's an older jail. So we're whether I have one or our max of 50, I have the same staff. So we're not able to shut just part of it down to save any money there. As far as our response, our deputies have been cut in half from when I started to what we are now. And we were looking at completely decimating them except for our contract deputies, which would have been two for Marine. And then myself, we would have been very similar to Josephine County. The concerns that I have is the bad guys read the paper. They know what's going on. Our drug cartels that we're dealing with the marijuana, especially in the southern Oregon part and in the northeastern part is a very big concern to the sheriffs. And without anybody there to at least slow it down is a grave concern. And we see this going to start snowballing and affecting a myriad of issues. And I think we get into a downward spiral. So I appreciate 4175. A couple years ago, I had brought this idea up, and we got beat up mercifully by the public. And so I'm glad that it did get through, and it will help us. But I would like to stress to the task force, this by no means is a fix. It is nothing but a Band-Aid, and eventually that money will run out as well. And that's pretty much all I'll have to say, but I'll be more than happy to stay and answer any questions.
Sheriff, would you identify yourself, please, by giving us your name?
Yeah, this is Sheriff John Bishop for Curry County.
Thank you very much. And I believe now, Commissioner Aitzen, you would like for your assessor?
Yes, thank you, Senator Berger. I'd like to introduce our assessor, Tax Collector Jim Colon, and I think he can comment on House Bill 4177 on behalf of our organization.
Welcome, Mr. Colon.
Thank you, Senator Berger, and good afternoon, committee members. Jim Colon, Curry County Assessor. In Curry County, we've been fortunate that the commissioners have always had a fairly strong commitment to assessment and taxation. And yet, Curry County is faced with less and less money, and there's always the question, do you put one more person in the assessor's office, or do you keep a deputy out protecting the public? And that's a tough question. I mean, it's not a question that I can look straight-faced at a county commissioner and tell them they need to keep more people in the assessor's office than the sheriff's office. With regards to House Bill 4177, I think we might be dancing just within the limits of what that allows for. 4177 essentially is allowing counties, if they're making less than a 15% cut, or a 15% or less cut in their assessment taxation programs, to continue their CAFA funding level at a level consistent with what it was last year. And that's where Curry County is. We've made about a 13% cut in this next coming year's budget. And but that still is subject to the Department of Revenue's review. I had the opportunity to speak with the acting administrator of the Property Tax Division, Oregon Department of Revenue, Mark Kinslow, a week or two ago, and they're very concerned about the level of resource that we're allowing for assessment taxation here in Curry County. And really all that I can assure him of is that for this year, this coming year, 2012-2013 tax year, is that we will put out an assessment roll, and we do have the people to collect the taxes according to the budget that we have this year, and we'll be able to maintain some other things. But since 2007, the assessment taxation department have been cut back from a level of 13.6 FTEs down to 6 or 7 today, well, for next year's budget. So the Department of Revenue, for their part, they want to come into Curry County and do an audit of where we're at with our assessment taxation program, and we welcome that. And it's always good to have another set of eyes. I mean, I'm sure they're going to come down and still be very concerned, if not outright refusal to let us continue at this level. But those couple of things that will be going on will make a difference for Curry County as to whether or not we're able to, if we're at a sufficient level, participate in the CAFA grant. which, as you all know, supplies about 20% of the cost of assessment taxation to the counties. Curry County, unlike the other counties we've heard up from, is a receiver county. That means that we receive more money from the CAFA grant than what we actually pay in the way of recordings in the county clerk's office, and then interest on late payment of property taxes. At the level that we are at in Curry County, we're having issues. We are we're taking shortcuts. We're putting things off. There's some things that by law we're required to do that we're just not doing. And we're allowed to we're able to continue doing what it is that we are still doing, really only because we're in such a deep recession and there's so little activity going with regards to property sales and new construction. But still, we lost one position this year. It was a position that in our office was fairly critical. It was a minimal entry-level position, but it was a position that allowed us to be as efficient as we possibly could in all the other positions that we have in the assessor's office, because it was a catch-all position. We gave it all of the help-out duties, for lack of a better word. I would say that in Curry County, our values are getting sloppy. It's going to get more difficult to defend our values. Fortunately, up to this point, we've had enough resource to be able to address taxpayer questions when they come in concerned about their values and able to come to a reasonable resolution on most of those. But as time goes by, I think with our values becoming sloppy, we'll have less and less time for defending our values. And I think that will snowball as the public learns that we're not able to defend our values. They'll appeal more often. So that's just a little bit of the background there. And it's hard to say where we go from here other than, you know, one thing that we do know is that Curry County only has a budget getting us through until June 30th, 2013.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Cohen, for your testimony. Commissioner, you wanted to close?
Yes, Co-Chair Berger, Hannah, and Roland, committee members, I appreciate, again, your giving us this time. I neglected to mention we also have our County Council, Jerry Herbage, with us. In that, I thought that when we reached the discussion on House Bill 4176, it might be useful to have him present. But my comment that we failed to utilize House Bill 4176. Technically, we declared a self-declared emergency, and our reason predominantly, as Commissioner Rhodes indicated, was we simply didn't have the money to afford what would be a minimum payment of $75,000 as estimated by the Department of Administrative Services, but it could have risen to as much as $150,000. And being as we're short of road deputies, it was difficult for us to rationalize that expenditure of funds. We, for some time, have been on the point of the spear here in Curry County in regards to the economic problems of resource-dependent counties. So I feel fortunate to be in the midst of this very talented, experienced crew that we're with. I'd open up the comments to Commissioner Waddle, who's been here longer than I have in the commissioner's position. Maybe you would like to comment on House Bill 4176 or our situation or any other aspect of this today. Oh, I have one other question, though. We were told that if we had some ideas about future innovation, that this might be an opportune time to bring them up to you. Is that Is that accurate, Senator Berger?
Well, not right now. I'd like for us to continue with the implementation of these three bills, because I want to give the committee members a chance to ask any questions. Committee, we've just heard from Commissioner Itzen, Mr. Bishop, who is the sheriff, and Assessor Jim Colon. And so I'm going to ask the commissioner a question, and then if any others want to follow with a question, that would be fine. Commissioner Itzen, I would like to know if, when you realized that you were not going to utilize House Bill 4176, did you go to AOC, for instance, and talk about options as to how you might be able to pay for your share of the Fiscal Emergency Board, Assistance Board, rather, the Fiscal Assistance Board?
Well, Coach Berger, we were in constant communication. This is Commissioner Itzen. We were in constant communication with AOC. There was some indication, and I do not recall who this or where this might have come from, that there might have been at some point some ability perhaps to fund the implementation of House Bill 4176 in our county by utilization of state emergency funds. I don't recall where that information might have come from, but after that we never did hear from anyone who volunteered to help us out. So there was no forthcoming offer of help to our county in a financial sense.
Well, this is not a criticism of your county or of anyone, but I just wonder, when you saw an opportunity to perhaps use it, if you reached out either to the governor's office or to AOC or to someone that might be able to give you some assistance in finding the $75,000. So that was my question. It was just simply to see kind of what your thinking was when you received the notification about this. So I'm going to open it up. Are there other questions from the committee? No other questions. All right. Well, then I think we will move on to Commissioner Hare.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. He's your guy.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to thank the task force and also Representative Hicks. I understand he's in the office. In the,
he is. Representative Hicks is here looking great. Yes, he's right here.
That's questionable.
Well, good. Heard a lot of testimony, and I don't want to be redundant. I think we're probably, as referred to, being at the tip of the spear. We're there. We recently had a tax levy that failed in Josephine County by what I consider a slim margin, even if it was substantial in some people's minds. 43 to 57 isn't necessarily that bad. Going through these three pieces of legislation that we're really appreciative of, 4175, making available road funds. We haven't actually made a determination by our board to utilize those. However, I'm inclined to think that we're going to, probably to the tune of around $500,000. Due to the failure of our recent public safety criminal justice system levy, we won't have any road funds that are built into our budget for we won't have any patrols for 2012-13 available. So these dollars are really well, they're really valuable. We really appreciate having access. We don't have the same reserves that other counties have. We have roughly $3.5 million. So it's a substantial percentage if we allocate $500,000 out of $3.5 million, much greater than what we're looking at in for instance, Klamath County at $105 million in reserves. But we are reluctant to do that, but appreciative that that's available.
Commissioner, it's
4176,
Commissioner.
I actually wrote down a couple of pages of notes on the eight or so points of interest. Maybe there's nine to qualify for this. And the suggestion that the Fiscal Assistance Board would be making on the different things that the county can do. We've frankly gone through all of those, and I guess to address Representative Hanna's issue about the idea that this is thought of, maybe that we already know that we're in a fiscal crisis situation, necessarily not needing somebody in to come in and tell us that, I guess I'm confused. I'm probably still confused, and maybe so the public is too, but what exactly 4176 would do for a county like Josephine County. And I'd be interested in hearing that. And so I won't necessarily go into all of the points of how we've addressed those, the reallocation, the laying off county employees, the lease of real or personal property of the county. So, but going into 4175, truly appreciate that as well. We are under the 15% reduction in our budget for to meet the CAFA.
That's 4177.
4177.
Yes, and Commissioner, would you introduce yourself, please? I'm sorry, but I failed to get you to introduce yourself. So would you do so?
I'm Simon Hare, Josephine County
right.
Commissioner and Sheriff.
All right. That was my fault. Thank you very much. Now continue on.
But I get started on this, and it's tough to stop me, so I apologize.
That's all right.
We're currently at 22.8 full-time equivalent employees in our assessment and taxation, and that includes our treasurer's office as well. Those are one elected official, and we're going to be reducing down to 19.35 full-time equivalents, so we're under that 15% reduction. But this isn't a new challenge that Josephine County has been making reductions for years. Since I took office in 2011, we've reduced staff by 33 full-time equivalents, saving roughly $2 to $2.5 million. There's a plethora of things that we've done. We've mandated that most county departments and programs be on reliant on either grants or fees, and not reliant on the general fund. So I think we've made good progress and trying to keep the doors open and maintain the services that we're required to perform under state mandates, and we will do that. We will serve civil papers, criminal papers, we will provide court security, and we will have a jail with a DA, and we will be contracting juvenile beds in Jackson County and closing our juvenile facility.
All right. Thank you very much. Members, any comments or questions? Yes, Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Simon Hare, Representative Hicks here. Now, you mentioned being able to provide for court security. The state has a direct interest in that, I would suggest, because we have the personnel in there and we're running our branch of government out of a county facility and guarded by the county. To what extent is the county going to be able to cover that requirement?
That's a great question, and honestly, I don't have a real concrete answer. It wasn't originally in, we're going through our budget process right now, so I have to apologize. It wasn't originally in the sheriff's budget to provide court security, and so we have recently kind of provided directive to our sheriff that that's something through Judge Baker, who's our lead judge here, to provide that direction, and we will make reallocations to provide that security. But it'll be at a very minimal level. We're right on the brink of having enough people to staff our jail. We do have a pod system in our jail, so we're blessed to have that. But our requirement right now is 17 full-time equivalents in our jail, and we have 16 budgeted. So we're still looking to try to come up for the funds for one more person. But I think somebody else was alluding to the idea that these people that are left are put in a situation under great stress and asked to do more duties than their job description entails, and we don't know how long that's going to last.
All right. I guess that I'd like to just take a stab at the House Bill 4176, and then perhaps my co-chairs would do the same. But one of the things that I think that we need to really think about, at least certainly we were thinking about, is if you are declared an emergency as a county in this economic distress, it's really not any different than any other kind of emergency. You need to know what process you can go through once you have been declared the emergency. So House Bill 4176 lays out some of that process, and it tries to help counties understand exactly what they can do, whether it's reallocating the funds, reducing services, entering into these intergovernmental agreements. It lists a number of things in trying to just assist the county, and that is the reason for the Fiscal Assistance Board. Once you're in an emergency, a new set of eyes coming in and helping you, and also opening channels of how you can partnership and create these agreements with others. And that might be a lot harder to do than it is to write in a bill. But I do think that it was a way of trying to clarify, once you have asked the state to declare the emergency, then you say, okay, we already knew we were in one, what do we do now? And so House Bill 4176 attempts to help you do that. Okay? Any other comments?
I would make a comment, if I might,
Madam Chair.
Okay,
yes, please.
Thank you, Commissioner Hare. Really appreciate your work down there. I would also just throw a little bit of a different definition at you in a couple of ways. One is, you mentioned 4176. How does that benefit the county? I think you got to think about that a little bit differently and say, how does it benefit the residents of the county? Because if you're looking for a way that says, how does somebody mail me a check to make it easier for me to handle government? The answer is probably it doesn't. But if you're asking yourself, if you as a county, as elected county officials, have set the designation of insolvency or the fiscal emergency, which would constitute the board, the difference between that insolvency and bankruptcy from this perspective is the county still has revenue. It's not like there's no revenue coming to the county. It's that there's not enough revenue coming to the county to maintain the current level of service that everyone would choose to have. The second piece of that is, in those shared services and ideas which were talked about even during the hearings and at other times, were things like shared health services. If a county health service department is just absolutely down to the point where they can't provide any service, and the state folks come in and say, well, gee, we still need to do immunizations, we still need to do the following things, we go find a partner, whether it's a local pharmacy or someone else, and the citizens of the county still benefit because those services that are necessary still happen. You don't get a check for it. We spend some money, probably so do you, still to get that to happen, but it's the whole shared service model. That was the idea. The second thing is, none of this is designed, and I'm going to say this out loud as clear as I can, none of these bills are designed to fix the problem. We heard the sheriff from Curry County say it's a Band-Aid. It's a little Band-Aid. The fix is harvest on these forests. The fix is the revenue that comes from harvest and the jobs created in the local communities on these forests. These issues that we're talking about truly are the Band-Aids. But it is the intention of this task force to work with you all at the county to get them right. So whether we have them right today, I can't say that they're perfect. And you know, my limited experience here in this building says we don't get it right the first time, every time, all that often. It takes some trial and error. But the intention is to get it right so that you have a backstop, and that backstop intended to be short term, and that we all focus on the real issue, which is, again, harvest level and revenue and jobs in our local communities in these ONC counties.
Co-Chair Roblin and then Representative Hicks.
Yeah, and I just want to mention the same thing, similar to what Representative Hanna was just saying. Our intent all along was that we know how difficult it is in these counties to make sure that your population understands how hard you have already worked. I think this lets another group of eyes get in there. It was not in the intention that we would try to do something over the top of. That's why we made sure that the commission was set up, that the local people will have a veto power over anything that's done. But we also have to make sure that we can speak as the county, as the state, when we're talking to our federal delegation, to really help them understand how serious this issue is and how important it is for us to figure out how to get back into the federal forest in a way that helps bring back an economy into these places. And I think we all, on this committee, were looking at that as one of the things that we were trying to make sure we were all going to have one voice. We would have all looked at this stuff, we would have all seen what was happening, and we would have all had one voice saying, we are not going to make it out of here without some other economies in our areas, and the other partner that has to join in with that will be the federal government in each and every one of the counties we've been talking about, because they're all ONC counties, they're all of those kinds of things. It takes the whole group working together to move forward, and that's our intention. It was our intention as we worked through this bill to try to figure out how do we line up so that people understand that, and how do we also have, maybe the state can help with the county that's next door helping with some of the health services. Maybe it's the cities within. We talked about Lane County being much more urbanized. Maybe we can contract the state, and that we can have conversations about how do we contract with the states to provide some of the police services outside of their areas. But those are big conversations that have to take place over turf issues, which we're past the conversation of turf problems in all of these counties. We need to get on to how do we provide the services for the citizens in those counties the best way and most efficiently we can. And we did understand that these were, in fact, all Band-Aids. If you go back and look at the task force from which a lot of this was devolved from, that Governor Kulongoski counted a number of years before, that was a big list, and we looked at those things on that we thought we could work with, but in every one of those conversations, we all understood that the real issue is how do we make sure that we can develop new revenue sources for these, or return to revenue sources we've had in the past, to get these counties coal. So one of the things that I hope, and we will get there, is that we ask, if there are other Band-Aids that you see, or other things that you can say that could make these work better to get us to that point where we can all be working together to move forward, we would love to hear those things.
Thank you, Co-Chair Roblin. Representative Hicks?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Public safety levy campaign recently concluded in Josephine County. It was actually very, very intense. Of 25,000 ballots turned in, only 2.5%. There was an undervote of only 2.5%. They didn't vote one way or the other on the levy. So 95.5% of the voters turned in a ballot and voted one way or the other on that question. Well, in the course of that campaign, House Bill 4176 got pretty thorough public vetting, and I think Commissioner Simon Hare knows exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, this was very highly studied, contemplated by the electorate, and really considered as one of the options. I think based on the reaction, the bill has enormous utility. The bill actually had enormous utility during the course of the campaign to advance the discussion as to the importance of local control. Quite frankly, it didn't matter what party people were a member of. They didn't want the state coming in and pushing their government around, the county government around. Right. And so now we did, we got pretty much most people educated that wasn't how it worked. The prior version of that statute that it amended did have language that would allow the governor to have come in and simply started calling, well, not calling the shots for the government, but he could have, you know, set up his commission. He could have done what he was able to do without the county having a real say in what the governor did. So that was greatly appreciated, actually. And the utility of that bill was that we did think in very serious terms about the value of county government, whether we want county government to continue doing what it is doing or what it isn't. And so even without having been implemented, I would say that was a worthy bill. And, you know, we didn't happen to pass the levy, but I think the discussion has been advanced for the purpose of that.
Well, in local government, there's always the story that goes around that the cities were formed first, and it was only when they realized that they had to do something that would tie the cities together that they formed counties. And it was only after the counties agreed that they needed a little bit of another structure that the state was formed, and it came last. So it's a nice story for local government. Commissioner Itzen, I want to go now. We have completed the discussion on the three House bills. I want to go back to the comment that was made about innovation. And let's hear what you have that you might suggest new ideas for us.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Again, this is Commissioner Itzen from Curry County. We have a number of ideas that could be of use as we move forward. One of the items that I would suggest would be useful to look at would be ORS 275.275, which is distribution of proceeds that can be acquired from lands acquired by counties due to tax foreclosure. We do have resources. We have lands with resources that could be used. I think the way the law is structured now, the proceeds must be divided among the taxing districts, in which case, in our case, I think there's over 50. I think that item could be looked at very closely, and that would be it could be extremely useful to counties such as ours. Beyond that, I'd open it up to fellow commissioners for any other ideas that we might have for you to consider. Commissioner Rhodes?
Well, thank you, Commissioner Itzen, and there again, co-chairs and committee.
If you'll introduce yourself, please introduce yourself.
This is Commissioner George Rhodes. The issue, I think, for our citizens is when we put something out there, if there's no consequence or inaction, then it's likely that it's not going to be supported when it comes to a tax initiative, either sales tax or property tax. In fact, I would suggest that it's very likely that the two incumbent commissioners here just recently failed to even win in the primary because we have been talking about a tax. And the consensus between among the citizens is that, you know, we already have enough money to support the services or that we're going to get the money from somewhere else. So they're not willing to step up and approve a tax increase or a levy to fund these programs. I heard something earlier about health care. Health care is not really the issue for Curry County. We're working to move our public health and human services out to a nonprofit agency. But public safety is the key agency. You know, if government has one number one priority, it should be to provide public safety. And we can't, based on our tax base of a little over $1.3 million here in Curry County, we can't continue to fund public safety. And there's no consequence to our citizens that they can realize. Obviously, there's a great consequence, and that's no public safety, but they kind of take it for granted or think the funding is going to come from somewhere else. So there needs to be some consequence. There needs to be some authority to levy enough tax to cover public safety, or there needs to be some authority that would allow the county to provide a bill for the fees that we, you know, for the services that we provide for the other municipalities and such. We collect all the taxes. We assess all the properties. We house all the people arrested in the county. We prosecute all the people arrested in the county. We provide all the juvenile services. And there's based on our tax base of 60 cents per thousand, there's no way that covers the cost of providing those services. So if we had the opportunity perhaps to bill for services, that might give people a little bit different picture of, you know, what the cost of the services really is. And it might give them the motivation to go out and support a levy. Right now in Curry County, and I'm not going to speak for other counties, but Curry County, there is just no there's no way that we're going to get a tax initiative passed to support these services, and it just isn't going to happen. Historically, if you look at it, it's not going to happen. And for us to continue to do the same old thing over and over and expect a different result, I think just shows you, as I believe it was Einstein that said, that is truly the definition of being crazy. So I'd think that there is some opportunities for the legislature to do some things to help us, and I would certainly like an opportunity within the next 6 months before I leave office to come and sit down with anyone there to have a discussion about what those might be.
All right.
So, Chair, this is Commissioner Itzen once again from,
yes.
From Curry County. I used to sit on an electric board, Coos Curry Electric, and we used to bill, we had a distinction that part of the billing was for basic services. I'm going to paraphrase here, it isn't exactly correct, but for those folks who were even absentee owners who might only be in the county for a month out of 12 months, there still were basic charges that were levied to those folks because it was recognized that there was a certain amount of basic infrastructure that was required for even those folks that were not living here year-round. Likewise, I think, as Commissioner Rhodes implied, there are things that we all as citizens of Oregon expect. You expect to have a certain amount of security for you and your family as you travel from Portland to Brookings or from Portland to Astoria. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there ought to be a basic level of security that's provided in this state that can be done on a statewide level so that citizens would feel secure no matter where they were in the state. I would suggest that would be better handled by the legislature than by our county. Commissioner Wall, did you have anything to add? I think that pretty well does it for us, Co-Chair. We really appreciate the opportunity to address you today.
Well, thank you very much, and I want to thank all the commissioners, those here in the room and those on the phone. Co-Chair Roman?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I also wanted to make sure that we stated, because all of us sitting up here are elected officials, and we know how tough that is. And the commissioners that are in Curry County, the commissioners that are sitting here, I applaud your willingness to get out there and do the work that the counties need. My senator has taught me well that city councilors have very important jobs in the same sense, because she actually worked through all those levels. And I think we forget sometimes the dedication that individuals make for their own particular places, whether it's city council or school boards or county commissioners. And I, for one, really appreciate all of you for taking the chance and the willingness to do that work. And I know that's true of a bunch of the rest of us here.
Thank you very much for those remarks. I will just an added note to the commissioners and to others that are online. When I read the list of the names of the people that were going to serve on this task force, I thought, you know, they really handpicked the people for this task force. They picked people that really understood local government and were going to do everything in the world that they could to try to help in this crisis. And I don't always feel that way when I look at lists of committees or commissions, but I felt that way very much about this task force. So thank you very much again, and we'll move on now to our next agenda item. And I would like to call on Mike MacArthur and Eric Schmidt to the table.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Verger, Co-Chairs, members of the committee. Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties. We've been asked to give you a quick update on what's going on with the federal legislation, and Eric is our reporter today.
Thank you, Mike, for that. I appreciate the update. Co-Chair Berger, members of the task force, Eric Schmidt, I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. The good news is that Congress is still considering a transportation bill. In that transportation bill is a one-year reauthorization of the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act, along with the PILT legislation, payment in lieu of taxes. I guess the sort of not so good news is that the conference committee that is debating this bill hasn't arrived at a conclusion over several other issues, not this one in particular, so the transportation bill is still high-centered. But we hope, and we are eternal optimists, that this one-year reauthorization will go through and that the transportation bill will pass soon. You have a handout, United States Senate at the top. There are three letters in there from members of Congress to the members of the conference committee, one from Senator Wyden to the members of the Senate Conference Committee, one from Congressman Walden to the Republican members of the conference committee, and one from Congresswoman Bonamici to the Democratic members of the conference committee. There are also two letters in the back from the Partnership for Rural America campaign, which is the driving campaign behind getting the reauthorization of secure rural schools through. We'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Madam Chair, if I may add to Eric's report that to remind the committee that the transportation bill provision for extension of secure rural schools is at the 95% of the last year's level, which is in many counties' estimation inadequate to maintain the basic level of service. It is something, but it's much lower level than we've seen in the past. And the other thing is that there's another vehicle as well still lingering in the House, and that's the so-called Hastings Bill 4019, which is a more active management bill. And we had hoped that if that bill ever to move, there would be a second title added to that, which would be the ONC Trust proposal. But so far, nothing's happening there.
Was it a good thing that this went into conference committee?
Yes.
Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, is Senator Dodd getting any closer on what he's trying to do with the federal forest? I mean, you know, that's the holdup's him, not...
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that bill seems to not be moving right now.
Okay, so he's still twisted. To use a technical term. We can't hardly run ours independently. It's got to come out of the committee, and Congressman Hastings wants his, but he, okay, frustrating. We got one good product and then one that is somewhat suspect.
The question I have is, what more can we as a legislature do? I look back at what's happening in Washington, D.C. The Democrats have dug in on one side. Republicans have dug in on another side. A lot of finger-pointing going on, and I don't see a lot of compromise. What can we do as a legislature acting bipartisanly to push some type of agenda? Because to me, it's a two-pronged solution. We need money, direct money, and then two, we need timber harvest. So what can we do to help you guys?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerard, I think continue to encourage our congressional delegation and to appreciate their efforts. I think on this conference committee, we've got Representative DeFazio, Representative Blumenauer, who are well-positioned to help move at least that provision that continues to secure rural school, and then encourage them to continue to work on the so-called ONC trust proposal that really gives us some hope in the Forest Service management approach. So I think our congressional delegation gets it, and they just need our support.
May I add something, Co-Chair? Senator Gerard, it's really important that this legislation not die. Senator Wyden made that very clear at a news conference in Portland in last March, that if secure rural schools goes away in this session of Congress, it's not coming back in 2013. So we need to keep it alive, and whatever help we can give our congressional delegation in terms of encouragement is greatly appreciated by them.
Co-Chair Hanna.
Thank you. Gentlemen, how many states receive secure rural school funding?
Good. 40.
40? And how many counties here in Oregon?
33.
That receive the funding?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So do you know, I mean, based on the letter that's part of this, the letter dated May 18th, it's part of the package that was provided, talks about the rural counties. I'm going to read partially from the letter. The rural counties that benefit from this program have faced devastating economic conditions over the last few years, some of the most depressed in the nation. Obviously, we know those counties within Oregon that are suffering from this. But not only do the projections show that the failure to renew secure rural schools will cause the loss of more than 11,000 jobs, and we've been having this conversation as part of a bipartisan legislature. It's all about the jobs. I talked about it in the last session. I'm going to keep talking about it. But getting the harvest plan fixed is so much more important, from my perspective, than renewing this. But now, it's not that I don't want to renew it. I want to renew it. I want to give them the bridge funding. But my question is a little like Senator Girard, except it's not so much how do we get this to work, but how do we get that other side? How do we get people to understand that these rural counties in Oregon that depend so desperately on this, it's about harvest levels. And how do we address the imbalance between not harvesting for whatever the reasons are and why we need to harvest so badly to fund critical services?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I think there are some efforts underway here in Oregon. We have the Federal Forest Advisory Committee Implementation Work Group, the economic study that you've signed a letter supporting. I think that will show the economic impact of working in the forest and an investment in those projects. We also have the active proposal around the trust, and I think that's just a matter of time before that begins to move forward. I think we have to, in Oregon, become united about what that proposal, the details of that proposal is. So because those lands are unique to the state of Oregon, I think we have a reasonable chance with Congress for their delegation behind that, bipartisan, in a bipartisan way. So I think it's a matter of perfecting that, and I understand the governor's office is going to lead that effort starting soon.
Well, has it been stressed that the industry and the counties here in Oregon, for one, have been so cooperative and that this is a cooperative effort that they're handling? And I mean, we're owned by the federal government. I mean, the forests are just, and if their management is going to just continue to decline and not be what it should be, we have no hopes of trying to turn things around. They've got to do something. Senator Johnson.
We've been mercifully spared significant conflagration the last few summers, but it may end up being with the bad forest management, particularly in the federal forests, that if we are subject to a horrific forest fire season this year, and we could be, to help make the case to the public of the insanity of watching these forests burn down. Because of lack of attention, lack of harvest, lack of human activity in them, it may take a conflagration as part of the public education piece of this. God forbid we have a bad forest fire season, but it easily could occur.
Representative McClellan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike, what is the Commissioner Rhodes mentioned in sort of his closing statement that there needs to be a consequence for inaction that the electorate in respective counties acknowledge or at least believe in order for there to be action. Do you agree with that statement?
Madam Chair, Representative McClain, yes, I do. I think that the actions of any given county have impacts on the state. Bonding rating could be impacted. Certainly public safety, people traveling through. So I think there's a greater responsibility there. And as Representative Hicks mentioned, when confronted with the possibility of someone dictating or someone stepping in to direct the activities of a county that's typically a county's responsibility, people may be more motivated to take local action.
Can I follow up?
Yes, follow up.
And maybe Representative Hicks might also weigh in, because the consequence of inaction, as Commissioner Rhodes said, has to be embraced. And I would imagine, because as Representative Hicks mentioned, there was a rigorous campaign in Josephine County, which I take you were aware of, what type of consequence do you believe we should communicate to counties awaits them for their continued inaction, other than what we've already said, which is you're going to be in insolvency and you're not going to have patrols? And so laying out the financial consequence doesn't seem to register.
Madam Chair, Representative McClain, part of the problem, I think, is the public's perception that the federal government will come through yet again.
There it is.
And that has happened so many times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still, that message is still out there, that, you know, they're considering this bill, the transportation bill, the federal government will come through. I think that what really has to happen, the consequence that has to happen, is people have to see what that level of service is really like. And they're about to see it in Josephine County. They're about to see it in Lane County, starting right away. And when they have to live with that level of service for a while, I think people will become concerned enough that they begin to take the action that's necessary.
But, and one last thing. Then, because I can tell you that they seem to be taking action when it comes to incumbents. Commissioners running in those counties who tell the truth.
Yeah.
But what can we do at the state level to assist the local county commissioners in trying to communicate that there is consequence for inaction? If there's nothing we can do, then what is the next step besides reaping what you sow?
Well, I liken the fiscal emergency somewhat to a natural disaster emergency. And I think we need to explore extraordinary powers that may be granted by the legislature to the executive branch for in those very worst circumstances when people's lives and welfare are at risk, that something could be done. But I don't know exactly legally how that can be done short of a constitutional referral.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Roebrun.
Yeah, thank you. And I tend to agree that there people need to see the consequence. The problem that I, you know, and I hadn't really thought about it until it was mentioned here by Commissioner Lycan. Lane County is an urban county with a lot of space in between. And so the people who are going to notice the problem are the people who live out there where there are no people. The people who are going to not notice it are the people who live in the urban areas, the cities, because they've still got police and they've still got other things happening right now. I mean, it could eventually be a problem. And so it's hard to get the people raised up enough to say, I'm going to vote for it because I'm voting for my friends outside in the other places, really, until they understand that all of the housed prisoners are in the county. I mean, that's when they start to realize it, when people are arrested and they're released because there's no place to put them. It seems like it's going to take so long for people to recognize some of that stuff that I may be looking at. And the original task force didn't have some of the safeguards that we had put in this bill. It really was talking about emergency services. And we kind of changed that in large part because a lot of our people here were involved with county government and didn't really want to go that next route. But you're saying that may be the only route. Is that what I'm hearing?
If I may comment, Madam Chair,
yes.
Representative Roden, the county's public safety responsibilities go far beyond just patrol in the rural areas. And so when crimes don't get prosecuted, when juvenile delinquents aren't taken in, when people are released
that
from jail, et cetera,
then
I think that those are consequences of the lack of ability to fund public safety.
Yeah, thanks.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, in Lane County, we have had some attempts to refund some county services, a number of them over the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, or 8 years. All of them have failed. They tend to get support, believe it or not, in the urban areas and not support in the more rural areas, and that seems to break down around political ideological lines rather than around the lines as to who actually benefits. But I think it's really important to note that, as was just stated, that a lot of the county services apply in the urban areas as much as they do in the rural areas. If you want a functioning court system, you have to have a functioning district attorney's office, you have to have a functioning sheriff's office, you have to have a jail that can actually hold people who are dangerous or who won't appear. You have to, in order to manage business needs for courts, the courts have to be open and they have to be available to litigants and they have to be able to manage civil process as well as criminal prosecution. I mean, there's and of course, not the least of which, the assessor needs to have staff to collect the taxes to pay for schools and the other things that the county collects taxes for. So the way I see this bill is it's not just some kind of a gimmick to to somehow come and interfere with county processes, but it becomes a way to kind of break the discussion as usual, which doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere, and bring in people from outside who can agree, along with the county commissioners, can say, look, this is real. We've gone through the books. We've looked at the numbers. We've tried to figure out where the money is and where it isn't. And we don't see any way around this that doesn't either involve a huge destruction of the kinds of services that everybody in the county depends upon, or some kind of a new approach or a new enterprise or a new willingness on the part of voters and taxpayers to deal with the issue. I'm hoping that if any county ends up using these facilities, and I know it's a huge jump to use that process. I hope that the approach will not be we've called in the experts from outside, but rather we have a big crisis. We need to figure out where we're going to go from here, and we hope that in the process of the conversation, we can get the people in the county to understand what the problem is, so that they can also participate in finding a solution. And if we do it that way, we have a shot. Now, that doesn't change any of the reality that the federal government is seriously shirking its responsibility when it fails to pay its share in lieu of taxes for the lands that it controls, or when it fails to manage the resources that it controls as a good landowner should, or when it fails to acknowledge the reality that Americans live in these counties and should have the expectation that those lands are going to be managed in a way that will promote forest health and the economy at the same time. And the federal government is doing a really poor job of that over and over and over and over again. I don't know how you get their attention, because we have congressional representatives and others who have been working hard at that for a long time and not seem to be getting very far. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, I've gone on beyond what I intended to say. We can, I think, if we use these tools correctly, maybe get some a change in the conversation, so that we can get a realignment in a way that will result in an improvement of these services.
Thank you. Other comments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're working hard to try and perfect the mechanism of the 4176. I think we saw it was, as you said earlier, Madam Chair, a rather quick process during the special session to get those bills out. We knew that it needed to go further. We were not sure exactly where that is, but we're continuing to work to try and improve that mechanism so that counties will be able to use it, as Representative Barnhart's described.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. I'm going to call Gil Rydell.
If I could
Senator Cruz.
Just one more query. First, Representative Barnhart, counties have cried wolf so many times, I do think the wheels have got to come off before people are at least in one place before anybody's going to take it seriously. That's just the reality. On the trust proposal, that the strategy has been, let's work the House, and then if we can get a miracle there, we work the Senate. Is that still the strategy? Because I think Senator Wyden may have potential conflict with what he's doing on the east side of the state, and then having this. Is that still the strategy, that we're working the House now, and if we can get that through the House, then we start on the Senate?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I believe that's correct.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Rydell.
You could be with Wyden. I think Murphy would be okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the task force, Gil Rydell, Association of Oregon Counties, and I hope you're not worn out by the discussion thus far, because I'm going to brief you on a very important and highly esoteric subject, that is assessment of taxation and county function, the county assessment function funding assistance account, or CAFA program.
I'll hit the highlights of the three pages of text that I provided you and referred to the tables and graphs as appropriate. The key point I want to make, though, is that three significant events since the adoption of this program in 1989 have resulted in a program that is not now, nor can it be, adequate or sustained. After the recession of the 1980s and the end of federal general revenue sharing and the severe across-the-board cutbacks that counties were forced to make at that time, the Property Tax Administration was in serious disarray. Stakeholders agreed to a new program adopted in 1989. It was intended to be a carrot-and-stick solution with review of the program by the 1997 legislature. I've listed the carrots and sticks, and I can explain any of them if you wish. I will note that this is when the new 4% interest on delinquent property taxes was adopted, and the CAFA fund was estimated to provide about 35% of the A&T costs. Three significant events have eroded the adequacy and sustainability of the CAFA program: ballot measures 5, 4950, and loss of federal forest payments. Before 1990, the property tax system was levy-based. If a county needed more revenue to provide for A&T or any of its public services, it could adjust its budget, seek voter approval, and the property tax rates would be adjusted based on the total value to collect the revenue. With ballot measure 5, the county and other general government budgets risked compression. If the rate needed to collect budgeted revenue for all of those districts exceeded $10 per thousand of assessed value, the risk of budget shortfalls caused by the structure of the property tax system had arrived. The 1997 legislature refined the CAFA program. It had dedicated an additional 25% of interest revenue on delinquent property taxes to CAFA, to the extent that it would not be distributed to schools or counties. And it extended the sunset for a legislative review of CAFA and the sunset on the freeze on local real estate transfer taxes by local governments. That same legislature was forced to deal with the second significant event that to prevent the adequacy and sustainability of the CAFA program, ballot measure 49, which could not be implemented as written. The legislative response was ballot measure 50, which converted the property tax system to a rate-based system, made property tax rates permanent, and severely limited growth and assessed value of a property. In addition to cementing inequities across taxable properties, Measure 50 made the bedrock revenue source for local governments increasingly inadequate over time. 1999 was the last refinement of the CAFA program, among other things, making permanent the program itself and the preemption on any new local real estate transfer taxes. Also in 1999, the legislature began appropriating $5 million to CAFA to partially support A&T work for the state-funded school system. These appropriations would continue until a reduced payment of $2 million in fiscal year 2008-2009 and then would stop altogether. Meanwhile, a DOR study in 2004 made findings that these legislative appropriations to CAFA were enacted as an alternative method to acknowledge the fact that schools benefit from a healthy A&T system but pay proportionately less for the benefits of that system when compared to other jurisdictions, and that the current level of funding allows all counties to fulfill most but not all of their critical program requirements, and that current funding does not adequately fund maximizing tax-generated revenue by maintaining active appraisal and admitted property discovery programs. These findings were made before the end of the legislative appropriations to CAFA. In 2008, Oregon faced the third significant event to harm the CAFA program, and that was the withering and potential loss of federal forest payments. This is illustrated by the bar chart titled History of Federal Forest Payments to Oregon Counties that you have there in your packet. The Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services made three recommendations on A&T, none of which has received final action. Counties and DOR have been exploring structural means to operate A&T more efficiently with fewer resources, including regionalization of some appropriate functions. We have an example where Lane County has contracted with Crook, Gillum, Lake, and Wheeler counties to provide technical support
for their same ENT software system. The CAFA program did not anticipate what followed it, the profound structural changes to the property tax system and the threat to federal forest payments. Moreover, except for three fiscal years, 2001-2004, CAFA has not fulfilled its promise of providing 35% of ANT costs. Presently, it's about 20%. This is illustrated by the bar chart titled Cost of County Property Assessment and Taxation and Funding Source, which is behind the earlier one that I mentioned. Notice that in spite of shrinking federal forest payments, the county portion of the bar is in green. The counties for the time being have been picking up the slack on A&T funding, but counties can no longer backfill the CAFA. You've earlier seen what we affectionately call JAWS, courtesy of your legislative revenue office. What it shows is in medium and long term, county resources fall further and further behind expenses. And then finally, note the pie chart that shows the small percentage of taxes imposed that are kept by counties. The current situation is of deep statewide concern. It threatens bonding authority of the state and local taxing districts. It leaves in operation a property tax system where critical functions are not adequately funded, such as discovering untaxed but taxable properties and collecting all collectible revenues for important public services. The system is not complete, and it's not fair to all taxpayers. An adequate and sustainable system, which provides the means for public safety, education, and other important public services, can be provided by an enterprise or fee-for-service system. That is, continue to explore appropriate opportunities for regionalization and other efficiencies, and have each type of taxing district, schools, cities, counties, and special districts, pay for the cost of A&T services at the percentage it receives of property taxes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, I opened the meeting with talking about the bills, and I said that CAFA was complex. But one thing that I need to ask you, though, you have in there the recording fee, the $9 to the $15. Help my memory here. I thought the county clerks brought the bill that actually passed, increasing it. Was that the bill that increased it to $9?
No, that was I'm not entirely sure what bill you're talking about, but I can tell you.
Well, it was well talked about. Senator Johnson, can you help me here? Do you remember that bill? County clerks brought the recording fee bill, and it was.
Madam Chair, my recollection was that the county clerks reacted negatively to the recording fee bill and had expected to get a portion of the proceeds for the increased workload in their offices, and that they were opposed.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson's referring to the latest increase in your fee recording fee, which had to do with low-income housing. That was done a couple of sessions ago. The refinements to the assessment and taxation system occurred in, shall we say, an era before that.
Okay. All right. Questions of Mr. Rydell? Any comments, Senator Johnson?
I guess this is an interesting recitation of the facts. What I see missing is the recommendation to the legislature. I know that you all have spent a fair amount of time compiling this and thinking about it, and I know you are not without opinion because you have shared it with me in other locations. Where's the recommendation piece that should accompany this?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, the last paragraph. If you switch from a filing fee and relying on delinquent property taxes, a portion of that, and you switch the channel, so to speak, to fee for service, and it could be 100%, it could be 35%, but a fee for service from each of the taxing districts, then I think you have a sustainable program.
I can follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow up.
I can close my eyes and see the array of opponents for that theory pass before me. I'm trying to think where the discussion even starts to try to move in a different direction in your fee-for-service model. Has a proposal been laid out as a straw man that people could react to in a way that changes the model? And obviously the advocates are not going to, any dime taken from any one of these places, somebody's going to be cranky about it. But is there a starting point? Have you all had the leadership to convene a group, or is the perceived opposition so insurmountable that you present a paper like this and that's as far as it goes? Are we waiting for somebody else to make the first move?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, good question. The AOC convened a group in the early 2000s that actually just preceded the Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services recommendation that there be greater participation by the taxing districts that benefit from assessment of taxation through more of the delinquent interest going into the CAFA fund. We had a bill and it passed the Senate without it unanimously and did not pass in the House. We understand that the issue is understood by everyone. We've talked about it to the taxing districts. They know about this. We've talked about it before, and now we believe we have the governor's office interested in talking about it. So it seems that if we are at maybe a starting point in that we sit down, see where we are today factually and financially, and then see what we can work out. That's what we'd like to see.
We are on the cusp, I think, of LOCs, what do they call it, town hall meetings, where legislators meet with city elected officials. I know that last year one of the things on their proposed pieces of legislation was some conversation about ballot measure 50. I found it fascinating as I went to those city meetings around my district, watching the family fall on each other and fight. City councilors couldn't agree that that was the way to move. But I'm just wondering what the mechanism is to convene any of these kind of broad thinking alternatives to the status quo, who takes responsibility for doing that, and whether or not you and cities find common mind in an approach and you together could work to advance that to the legislature. I'm just trying to hunt for who makes the first move.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, we've had informal discussions both with the Department of Revenue and with the Governor's Office about a conversation, starting another conversation under the new reality. We're hoping that'll bear fruit.
Co-Chair Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we did have a conversation, I think, one or two sessions ago regarding special districts had to pay for their own elections if they wanted to have certain elections, and the conversation about annexation and its cost should be transferred to the county so they didn't have to pay for it because there were a number of elections that were happening and it cost a lot more for the election. It all got shifted to the county for the payment. So I know the conversations have been taking place over the last number of sessions around elections and taxation and so on. So I hope that we're at a point where we can have a conversation about this.
Well, Madam Chair, we had three recommendations in the Governor's Task Force report, and unfortunately, the finance situation, the public finance situation, took a dive as soon as the report was issued. So it removed the appetite for doing some of the things. But there was the idea of an increased recording fee, which was basically preempted by the low-income housing increase. There's the increased state general fund to A&T recommendation to pick up the full cost of the school's portion of A&T work, and then all delinquent interest and property taxes going to the CAFA, and that's the bill that we introduced and passed the Senate but didn't make it through the House.
I guess that one of the concerns that I would have is that this task force not be involved prematurely. In other words, I think that there is a process that the counties and their partners need to work to some point before you bring in, because I think we need to be sensitive to the criticism that they don't want big government coming in. So I think it's premature for us. I think you need to do some more work. At some point, I think we need to be a partner with you in this discussion, but I think that it's not now.
Madam Chair, we agree completely. That's hence the informal conversations with Department of Revenue and the Governor's Office. And,
yes.
And we'll try to get something started and see if we can come to some kind of understanding, and then it would be a matter of legislation.
All right. Well, I appreciate your being here today, and thank you very much for a good report. Members, that is the end of our agenda, and...
Do we know if there's any of the county commissioners that might have something to say? Do they have any? Or do they all leave?
I think that they will. I'm just too nervous to actually hang
up. Okay. I was just worried. I saw the green light on. I wondered if any of the county commissioners were still on the line.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, they're probably just listening. Yeah. All right, members. Well, Senator Ferriola, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I sat through this meeting, I realized that I started sitting in this meeting 15 years ago. And, you know, I think it was two doors down where I first encountered a guy named Will Stell, who was here from the National Marine Fisheries Service to implement the Clinton vision of the salmon plan, salmon restorations. And that started us on a trajectory of diminishing returns for all natural resource management in Oregon. And part of the response to that was we, as legislators, were going to produce a plan that would be better than whatever the feds would do to us. And we did that successfully. We actually even beat back the attempt at listing the coastal coho salmon. It was a heroic effort, overturned into courts. And we ultimately got the listing. And, you know, I was just Googling some stuff here, and I realized that this administration a year ago or so appointed the same guy to be the National Marine Fisheries Service Director for the Oregon region. So the trajectory that we were on 15 years ago really has not changed, even though we've had, you know, several administrations from here to there. And what's interesting about that is every time we've seen a renewal of the Secure Schools and Community Self-Determination Act, it's come with an admonition that this is the last time we're going to do this. The first time they did it, they said, we're going to buy you 5 years or so to diversify community economies. So, you know, you get this much time to diversify. And when we asked, you know, how should we diversify, they pointed out communities that were far more urbanized. We'll be more like these communities. You know, have better economies, but not timber-based.
Yeah, right.
And for gosh sakes, take care of your salmon.
Yeah.
So, you know, we got the first renewal, then we got the second renewal, and what they told us on the second renewal is, we're never going to do this again. You know, you get through this renewal, we're just not going to do this again. Go forth and do good work, diversify your community. But by the way, we now have buffers on the stream and circles on the maps, which are no touch areas, no harvest areas, no go areas, no development, no utilization of that land base. And from that point to this point, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've had 2-year and 1-year extensions. And every time we get an extension, they tell us, we're never going to do this again. By golly, I believe them. This is just inertia. You know, this... If this bill passes in Congress in any form, it's just inertia. It isn't because they feel any obligation to help rural communities stabilize, or they even know where Oregon is on the map, to be truthful. A handful of delegation members know and are concerned, but the rest of Congress really doesn't care. So, you know, I'm curious about knowing from the members, and I'm sorry that the co-speaker is not here to answer the question, but what level of confidence do we have that this administration or the legislature, the federal legislature, will ever manage Oregon natural resources with the objective of sustaining communities? And if we have no confidence in that question, if that's a sort of a no-confidence issue, then all of our sharply worded letters and gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands won't produce enough transfers from the federal government to sustain rural communities. And so we're going to have discussions like we're having today about diminishing returns and how to create a higher rate of taxation on fewer transactions. Now, that's what diminishing returns is. That's what the county folks, you know, are telling us. That's what the county recorders are saying. Gee, you know, it used to be a dollar a page, and we did a lot of business, and we covered our expenses, and then it went to two, and then it went to five, and then it went to nine, and what is it, $15? And people are figuring out ways not to pay the $15, and that ought not be rocket science, because we should know that people avoid fees and taxes whenever they get a chance to. And all of our discussions about raising the rate simply means less total income over a longer period of time, not more. So if we're convinced that we that there is no expectation that this administration, which, by the way, has already written a check for $1.9 billion to us for health care reform, if we have no confidence that this administration is going to do what it needs to do to stabilize and sustain rural communities through federal transfers, then the question for us as legislators, which I asked the first meeting we had here, is what are we as legislators willing to do to change the equation? What are we willing to do? Now, we've had some lectures from constitutionalists that have told us federal authority is limited. State authority is plenty potentiary and unlimited. We don't act like it's unlimited. We act like whatever the feds say goes. And so here's what's happening. Oregon is cooperative in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of agreements all over that cover water management and forest management and wildlife management and transportation management. You know, virtually every area where we interface with the federal government, Oregon participates, and there's an income stream there. We are paying something. You know, and so far, we've congratulated ourselves on putting in 40 cents for every 60 cents. Look where we're at. We can't sustain what we have. Instead of we being the 60% participant and in control of our own destiny, we're just becoming a recipient of federal welfare in its myriad forms from a bankrupt central government that's so far in debt it can't possibly respond to all the needs everywhere. And they're going to say no, because they will. So the question is, if we have no confidence in this continued transfers by the administration, you know, and the same trajectory, because Will Stell didn't get appointed by accident, what are we willing to do to take over management of our own natural resources? Are we willing to, for instance, cancel all of our cooperative agreements with the federal government because they mismanaged our natural resource base, our fish base, our water base, our timber base? Are we willing to say these are Oregon forests first, and these are Oregon communities that are suffering, and it's no mystery that an absentee manager 3,000 miles away doesn't care about that stuff, or they'll write a press release that sounds sympathetic, and they'll send you a token payment, but they won't let you manage your own affairs. And the irony of it is that we're in charge of managing our own affairs. This is our watch. And so the question for legislators is, what are you willing to do to change this equation? You know, shall we all sign another sharply worded letter? You know, shall several of us delegate people to go to Washington, D.C. to plead for more federal transfers from the bankrupt central government? Or shall we assert that we have the management responsibility for our own forests and our own fish and our own wildlife and our own water and start taking action to disentangle ourselves from federal authority and let them sue us? Like they would anyway, they will anyway. But until we have that confrontation based on the assertion that these are our resources and our communities and own the responsibility for the sustainability of rural communities and local communities and not try to shove it off on the federal government, we're not going to get anywhere. We're just going to keep having this meeting. And I'm willing to have it for another 4 or 5 years, but I'd really like to see what legislators are willing to do to take control of our destiny and take our responsibility for these rural communities and stop sucking after federal transfer money, when what we really need to do is take the authority based on the facts that these are and have been and always will be Oregon forests first.
Senator Perioli, how much confidence do you have that we would ever be successful in such a venture?
The same amount of confidence at this point that I have that the federal government's going to continue to write multi-billion dollar checks so that we can keep Coos County and Curry County from going bankrupt. I don't have any confidence at all. But I'm not willing to sit here and do the same thing over and over and over to expect a different outcome, because that's what we're doing. You know, and I think we've been lucky to get as much extension as we have. But one of the dirty little secrets of the Secure Schools and Community Self-Determination Act is of the 40 states to get money, guess who's the big winner?
We are.
We are. And you know what? It's 3.5 million people stuck way out on the West Coast, a long way from political epicenters and a long way from any critical mass that would make a difference to politicians on the East Coast. And the proof is that every year they sort of cut you in a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. Then they got to just think that we're stubborn because we haven't gotten the message that this is going to end. Well, for all practical purposes, it's over. And so now the question is, whose responsibility is it? It's obviously, by de facto proof of their actions, it's not the federal agencies' heads and the administration that will take responsibility. Let me make this clear. It didn't happen in the Clinton administration, and it didn't happen in the Bush administration, and it didn't happen in the Bush administration, and it ain't going to happen in the Obama administration. And I don't care who gets the next call to duty as the President of the United States, they are not going to solve our problem in 5 or 6 rural counties in Oregon. They just don't care about that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't rise to the level of a crisis. And we are the ones that are going to be responsible when all of those counties go upside down and their PERS obligations come to the state and there's nobody to pay the bill. And when the assessment and taxation departments go, they wink out one after another. And now you have nobody to administer the assessment process that produces local revenue for local taxing districts. And they will wink out one after another. So none of this is theoretical. This is actually happening. What are legislators willing to do?
I have a question for you, though, and that is, realistically, how many Oregonians would be supportive of the state, actually, even if you could win, taking over that many, management of that many forests?
You know, the question's never been put to Oregonians in a way that it should be put to them.
That's true.
When students in rural communities who have the same right to ADMW education and the same right to program quality and content as urban school kids do, when their parents say, here's the level of transfer that you have to make to rural schools from the state treasurer to keep them on parity with other schools, when those kind of things start to really suppress the quality of schools in urban areas, people are going to say, hey, is this a class warfare, and is it just population-based, or is it a red-blue map issue? Or is it a question of whether or not we're going to manage all of our communities to be sustainable or not? And my point is, I think rural communities may be the canary in the mine, because when rural communities fail and stop producing, urban communities are going to follow the curve, and it'll be a one-to-one corollary. So,
well, having recently sat through a very interesting meeting in which it took 10 years to get the land board in Oregon to agree to cut a little bit more in the Elliott Forest that isn't even close to the sustainable yield, and to see the pushback that came on that, and if you notice in the paper last week, the Secretary of State is still having to explain her vote. And so it was almost comical that, that she would ever have to explain that vote because it was so far beneath what was, is going to harm anything in the forest. So I have, you know, I have certainly some concerns. I can understand your frustration, and I can understand actually the federal government doesn't manage their things very well, and I think we would manage them a lot better. But
Madam Chair, I think the obligation, if I may engage in a colloquy because there are other hands up, you're right. You're absolutely right. You know, the progressives have such a stranglehold on the Oregon political process that to even mention managing sustainably causes people to start to go for the ramparts and reach for the cudgels, the political cudgels. The only place to have the discussion and make it respectful and productive is in this building among our colleagues. And so it comes back to this. Our duty is to make sure that communities are sustainable wherever they are, and that means that we're going to have conversations with our colleagues about what to do when not just the urban communities, I mean rural communities wink out, because to tell you the truth, I represent 10 counties with a population density of 0.13 persons per, well, 0.30 persons per square mile. You know, that is many times below what the definition of federal definition of frontier is per square mile. You know, I'd have to grow 18 times to get to frontier. But I don't consider Lane County to be as rural as what frontier is. It's urban. You know, many places that our rural legislators live and work are on transportation corridors and have airports, and they are not what I'd consider to be rural. Come with me, I'll show you rural. You live in rural. You know, the population density is pretty low there. So I guess the case, the better case for us is to be, is to make it to 90 people in this building to take action to make their schools as sustainable in the urban areas as we need them to be in the rural areas, their hospitals, their road systems, et cetera. So we don't have to have an argument about diminishing returns at the assessment and taxation departments, which we cannot save, by the way. You know, raising rates will not save A&D departments in communities where the county government has collapsed.
Well, it's very difficult to even consider ever going to the taxpayers asking them for more money when we cannot do some of the things that we need to do ourselves. So, Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to kind of chime in a little bit about the frustration. I come obviously from timber areas that have been impacted tremendously by the feds. And I do agree with Senator Farioli. Why does someone from Pennsylvania or New Jersey or New York or anywhere on the East Coast want to vote for some for counties in Oregon? And I don't think we've had the answers up until lately, and I think something is changing, and I think there is something to be a little bit optimistic about, and that is the front and center approach of climate change and the fact that greenhouse gases really is a caveat to give them a reason to vote for more timber harvest. If everyone, if we educate the East Coast that the amount of carbon that goes up in a forest fire in Oregon on an annual basis is about five times all the fossil fuels we burn out here. And the easy way to reduce the carbon footprint, I do think that that in the long run will give a reason for someone in Pennsylvania and New Jersey to do that. How long that educational process is going to take, I don't know. But that's the only optimism I can see. Otherwise, I think what Senator Farioli says is absolutely correct. It's extremely frustrating because half the people on the East Coast don't even know that Oregon's on the coast. You know, it's just the way that it is. So that would be my two bits worth.
Thank you for those remarks. Any other remarks?
Briefly, it'd be an interesting challenge where Senator Farioli put on the table. For the most part, when the federal government says something, the states just blink and go, okay, nobody ever challenges them. I mean, if you look at the strict interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, the federal government's doing a lot of things they don't have the authority to do. And so the question is, if we decided we're going to take over management of our own resources, and they don't like it, we say, so what, and we continue to do it. They sue us, and even if they win, what are they going to do, put Oregon in jail? I mean, you know, it would be an interesting exercise in democracy, I think, and an interesting exercise in constitutional law, because nobody ever challenges what the federal government says. We just say, okay, thank you very much, and we take the little pittance of federal money that comes with whatever decree they send down, and nobody challenges them. And I think at some point in time, I've been hungry for an attorney general or governor of the state of Oregon in the 16 years I've been here that would be willing to challenge the federal government, and we have yet to have one. And they, you know, they have the standing to go to court, and I don't see that happening in this administration.
Well, the rhetoric of states' rights is it takes me back to the 1800s, and I think maybe we're just modern.
Madam Chairman,
as we protest.
Madam Chairman, I don't want to wrap myself in the flag or fight the Civil War. What I'm suggesting is that Oregon could explore nuisance abatement to deal with bug infestations on the land base that includes all land ownerships. And part of that, in fact, has to do with getting rid of dead and dying timber. We could do threat assessments for wildfire and conclude that a threat assessment producing a wildfire index higher than X is a threat to the community, and a nuisance abatement ordinance that applies to all landowners might produce a different outcome than standing around waiting for the lightning. So, Madam Chairman, I am not talking about, you know.
But to do that in a timely fashion, you have to ignore NEPA and do our own assessment. And so there you're challenging the feds.
Well, the wonderful thing about the legislature is that you are elected by the people to come here and to show all the leadership that you can. And there is a process open to you. And so I would suggest that if you feel that this has some realm of possibility, that you have some leadership and see what happens. It's an interesting discussion, Senator Farioli.
Very interesting discussion. I think it's more.
I do not want to be a wet blanket here. I just happen to have just sat through a meeting of probably 90% of the people in the room that disagreed with me. So I have to say that your success rate is a little bit a stretch for me right now.
I don't disagree, Madam Chair. I will just tell you that what we need to do, at least, is to frame the discussion differently than we have been. You know, waiting for more federal transfers in this environment is probably a longer shot than getting stewardship contracting implemented on the national forest land that would do some of the stuff I'm talking about. Yes. And comply with NEPA.
Yes, I do hear you. All right, members, I'm going to, with that, call the meeting adjourned.